Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 24th, 2017, and welcome to episode 159 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, writing games, and other stuff. So joining me today, we have several old bees and a newbie to our round table. So starting with the regulars, we have Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you, Carrington?
I'm an old bee. I was like, what the heck's an old bee? Like, I make stale honey. But then I understood eventually. Yes.
Yeah, drone.
Yes, I
always wondered what the opposite of newbie was. Then, now I know, it's an old bee.
Turns out it's me. And yet, in another way, I am the ultimate newbie. So, anyway, I'm here. Hello.
Hello. And I have to admit, I did actually borrow that from Doug Benson. But at any rate, good to have you back. Joining us from Australia, continuing the Commonwealth theme, is Michael Mulhern. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, except for some bruises and various bites which are irritating me.
Is there more to the story?
Yeah, I slipped on some loose leaves and dirts on some rocks on my property and slid down. Fortunately, nothing was really wounded apart from my pride, and also cleaning up, managed to find a ant nest with some mean little, and not too little, I think they're about 3/4 to an inch large, ants, which decided that they were going to snack on
That's
me.
Not an so, ant? That's like a baby.
I know. You aim a radioactive ray at it, and then you turn it. Yeah, then you turn it into a 50s movie with giant ants. Yeah, I know.
You're already giant. That's crazy. And also leaves and dirt. You live a very different lifestyle.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I live among concrete and anger in a city like people are supposed to.
This is why I don't go outside. But I'm glad you're okay.
Yeah, I survived.
And okay, so the new person today, the newbie, is Mark Lemmert, who's joining us from Wisconsin. How are you, Mark?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
You again.
Why does Carrington always say that whenever I'm on the same show?
I told you can't shake me that easy, Mark.
Right. Yeah, so Carrington and Mark were just on an episode of Open Apple that you can listen to.
Where we scoop the RCR.
Yeah. For once. I'm remembering a scene from Johnny Dangerously.
But, yes, you can hang me on a hook once. Once.
So, okay, well, anyway, here we all are. The host's topic today, I'm the host. Oh, yes. Have I said me? I don't know. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I never managed to get that part out, but...
Hi, Paul.
Okay, so the host topic today will be retro gaming evolution. And the question before us is basically writing games... particularly for old hardware in our new modern context. And so there are a couple different angles on this. You can, some people have taken retro hardware, but with the new improvements that we get with like flash drives and that sort of stuff, and written stuff for old hardware with these new add-ons, things that couldn't have existed back then, but take advantage of things that we sort of now have available. Another way to go at this is to write things that could very well have run in the 1980s, but using modern advancements in thinking about coding, user interfaces, using cross assemblers, syntax coloring, that kind of stuff that weren't available then. And it's interesting just to kind of think about what can still be kind of squeezed out of these machines. Like I often think about this with respect to the Apple III, but I mean, it's true for all of these, that like the industry moved on faster, like before we had exhausted what that machine could do. And so it's interesting to kind of see what people are doing now with these. So maybe we can start. Mark is one of the, I think, co-founders of a project called Nox Archaist, which, if you haven't heard about it, well, you'll hear some about it here, and there are other places, other podcasts where he's talked about it, and he's got a Kickstarter that he will tell us about. But so maybe actually, Mark, you could start to sort of say a couple of things about some of these things, and we can all chime in and interrupt each other.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds good. And you know, one thing that you said that really resonates with me is how I think, as you put it, you know, the industry kind of moved on, computing industry kind of moved on before the Apple II's, you know, horsepower is really, you know, was fully utilized with the software out there. Games in particular, because, you know, games were, you know, always kind of leading the edge in terms of the resource requirements. And that's really something, getting into my project with Nox Archaist, that I was curious about and really didn't know going into it. I kind of saw Ultima 5 as being the benchmark. You know, that was the, you know, most advanced RPG, of course, ever released on the Apple II platform. And then I had heard stories about, well, Origin tried to write Ultima 6 on the Apple II and, you know, just got to a point that they gave up and scrapped it at great expense and switched, you know, over to the PC. So, you know, I guess in my approaching this, I really wanted to find out, was it possible to, in any, you know, I guess kind of meaningful way, develop gameplay technology for tile RPGs that was beyond what Ultima 5 had achieved, or was the machine just, you know, tapped, so to speak? And so, you know, we've had a lot of fun exploring that exact question.
And I realized that I did kind of leave out an important detail, which was that Nox Archaist is a tile-based RPG that will be coming, that you're working on, and will be coming out you know, like a year-ish from now, right?
Yeah, we're shooting for December 2018. That's the current target date. And yeah, absolutely. It's a 8-bit tile-based RPG, sword and sorcery themed. And, you know, the player would, you know, experience all the things one would expect in that kind of game. You know, dungeons, towns, castles, NPCs to have conversations with, and turn-based strategic combat, and so on.
Excellent. Oh, maybe actually one other question. This is targeted just for the Apple II, or is that correct?
It is being developed on an Apple II or via a cross-assembler on an Apple II. We're, you know, regularly burning disk images on real floppy and testing. And, of course, PCs and Macs, modern PCs and Macs, can play via emulator. But there's no other other ports or anything like that planned right now.
Second Commodore 64.
Right.
And actually, to be clear, I mean, ports are something that we're you know, very enthused about doing potentially at some point. We're just looking at them as future projects after the initial release, and along with, you know, maybe an Apple IIgs, you know, version. You know, there's more interesting future projects than I can get my arms around at this point. But certainly we're not looking at a simultaneous release on multi-platform.
Sure. What is your role in it? Are you sort of primarily programmer, or do you share programming responsibilities? Do you have a part of the engine that you've specialized in, or do you handling the business end, or you have some sort of business background, right?
Yes, that's correct. My usual disclaimer is I am not a professional programmer. I was on that track once upon a time and had some IT-related, programming-related classes years ago. But ultimately, my career ended up in finance and business management. And, you know, with, a foot always still stuck in the IT world where I started, which, you know, I found to always be really helpful as far as being able to bring both perspectives to the table. And when it comes to a project like this, having returned to, you know, what I see as my roots as a kid and early professional career in technology, it's just been, you know, real convenient that I'm able to manage the business side of the project as well as do the coding. And so, back to your original question, I'm the, I guess I'd say the lead programmer, the primary programmer. I've written the entire game engine. I also have on the team Q-Kumba, the legendary Q-Kumba that we all know. He joined up formally last spring, and he's working on low-level programming like File.io. As everybody probably knows, he wrote RWTS disk controller called ProRWTS. And there's a number of customizations that he's worked on for NoxRKS to really help bring out some pretty cool features. And then additionally, he's working on copy protection for NoxRKS on the 5 1/4 inch version. So that'll be pretty cool to see what he does there, applying his skills on the other side of the fence, so to speak. But that is the programming team. we do have a larger team, as you probably know, seven of us in total. And the other team members, they're contributing very specific skills, like, for example, graphics design and print art design or sound. And my co-founder, Mike Reimer, he heads up all the production of the physical feelies, for example, that are associated with the Kickstarter that we have going. And also manages our website and things like that. Because ultimately, as we all probably know, at least tangentially, if not from some hands-on experience, games are, to produce a game, a real high-quality game, it's about a lot more than the coding. Sometimes I wish I wouldn't, because I'm just having a blast doing the coding. That's really where I'm having the fun with this from a hobby perspective. But there's all these other things that have to get wrapped in. And that's where I really, started to branch out and, with other team members is, how to cover some of these specialized areas that, maybe I could kind of do or fake my way through, like, at the art. But ultimately, we'd get done a lot better if there was somebody that actually knew what they're doing. And in those areas, the team members, they're specialists. Are people doing art, they're professional artists. And, the person doing sound, he's a professional musician. And that's kind of how we've approached it from a team standpoint.
Cool. You are writing this in kind of like a modern context, but to be run on machines, like, so I assume that you don't need any special hardware. You could take your Apple IIe from the attic and run it. But what sort of modern ideas have you? How did the modern context influence what you're ending up with here?
From a modern perspective, one of the first things that really kind of occurred to us that we thought would be kind of cool to have would be pop-up windows. And pop-up windows enabled us to think in terms of enlarging the screen, whereas tile RPGs in the 80s had about a third of the screen reserved for like text windows on the right-hand side, and then two-thirds, were the map. That was a format that there were a number of reasons I think that format was done.
Right. I think we were all there when Quinn was pointing out the eight bit part of the window.
That's exactly what I was thinking of when I said that. There were a number of reasons for that. Yeah, speed was absolutely one of them. And I'm actually glad you bring that up, because I know I've talked a little bit about the pop up windows and the full screen. I think on assembly lines. But that touches on a really interesting point, and to go about this process of making a full screen or almost full screen display in NoxRKS and then putting in the pop-up windows, it was a really nervous situation, because I knew that going full screen was going to take more speed. We were going to get out of that 8-bit zone. There's more, just simply more tiles being drawn on the screen, and This was basically one of those moments of thinking back to the point we're talking about before of how much of the machine is left, where it was a gamble that there was enough of the machine left, enough that optimizations and things that could be done on the speed end, that it was going to be able to work. It obviously turned out that it did work out. I've shown a number of gameplay videos with the near full screen display, and the players clipping along just fine, and pop-up windows appear when they need, and it worked out from a speed perspective. But really, I think what it comes down to, this be an interesting compare and contrast for anybody who remembers playing Ultima. The Ultima 4 and 5 in particular, there was a mode when you were in the boat, I think it was when you're or in a ship or a boat, where you set the sails, and then the boat goes a lot faster when the sails are set based on the direction of the winds. And, well, of course, the boat doesn't move. The boat's in the center of the screen, and it's the tiles that are moving. And it's like all of a sudden it's like going ludicrous speed when you set those sails, and you crash into land on the other side of the ocean pretty quick if you're not careful. And that was the first clue to me that there's more speed there, because in order for Ultima to have produced that effect, the engine had to have been capable of basically rendering the screen a lot faster than it usually was. Everything else had to have been slowed down, you know, from that top speed point. So I thought, okay, it should at least be achievable, you know, to get to that point, even if there's nothing else left. And it kind of became an exercise in, well, maybe instead of using that speed to make boats go insanely fast, we can use that speed to do something else. That was kind of the thought process that went through in making that decision to make the gamble for full screen mode.
Do you feel like you've kind of bumped up against memory limitations yet? I mean, like that's even just beyond the speed. I know that's one thing that is kind of a frustration, is that, you know, like at some point you run into DOS or ROM.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a lot of things we've done to optimize memory. We've also fully utilized auxiliary memory, which was something in the Ultimate games. They were using auxiliary memory for Mockingboard support, and we're using auxiliary memory for all sorts of things. And so we've essentially reprioritized the game a little bit to get more memory available. We've done some optimizations, but ultimately, in the end, we're up against the memory ceiling. We're fortunately, the core functions of the game engine are done, and we're more, you know, kind of pruning at this point to try to tease out little extra things to work it really well into the storyline. But it's basically at the point where to add anything more in terms of features, we have to optimize something else, because we've hit the ceiling. And there's a fair amount of optimizing left that can be done. So, you know, I'm feeling overall, you know, pretty good about, being able to implement the game as it's been intended. But definitely it's at a point where the list of things that we would like to do, but really just can't do because of the memory limitations, we're there. However, we've accomplished a lot as far as being able to push that frontier and add features that, you know, have not been seen before in Apple II games. If I could do it all over again, I've made lots of notes in the source code on optimizations, and some of them are things that can be optimized on the fly, but a lot of them are architectural, where it's like, okay, if I started over, I can imagine how, you know, to have built an engine that was substantially more efficient than the one that we have. So I think the really cool thing is that when NoxRcast is done, it will, you know, solidly push the frontier past what we've seen, and it won't be at the edge of the machine yet. There will still be, you know, a theoretical possibility there that either we could do a sequel, or somebody else could pick up the torch at some point and push the, you know, frontier even further.
Speaking of the memory, that does bring up a point, I think, that relates to the topic as well, which is, like, back in the day, it would have been a financial consideration for game sales to think of the memory target. You put out your game and go, we're going to target 64K or 48K or whatever, and the higher you make that target, the technically fewer people out there that could buy your game. But in a modern context, everybody has everything. You don't have 128K in your Apple II. That's just because you're choosing not to. Put more RAM in. It's cheap as heck now. Everybody can afford the greatest machine ever, things that we couldn't maybe have afforded back then. So it's, you know, Nox can target 128K Apple II and not worry that it's going to artificially knock off 20% of your potential sales.
That's exactly right. And that's something I wasn't sure on in the beginning. And this is a good example of where Beth Daggert really helped out. One of our team members, or I refer to her as our project advisor. She has a lot of experience in both the vintage and modern gaming industries, including on projects like Loadrunner Online and many others. And I asked her that question. I'm like, should we use 128K or not? You know, and she basically gave me permission to use 128K because I didn't know. And she's like, yeah, no, at this point, go for it. There's no reason not to. And I do understand, and to any 2+ users out there, I do understand that there are folks that would really like, you know, to see games continue to be released and Nox or Chaos to be released and fit in the 64K. And you know, that it was a difficult decision to make, and definitely one. I'll admit I'm glad that we could, because I really wanted the opportunity to be able to push the frontier as soon as possible. But I do understand there are still fans out there for the machines that don't have the capability.
So it's still the Apple II has two modes, so the like double high res that you get with 128K most of the time, and single high res, which dates back to, you know, 1977. But it is a single high res game, correct?
Yes, it is single high res. That was a decision point early on before I did anything in the graphics engine, which was really the first thing I did. I had to make that decision, single or double. And I wasn't aware of any double high-res games. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, you know, there might be a good reason for that. And ultimately decided to go with single high-res. It was the safer bet. And I'm glad I did, because as I learned more, you know, by doing, and also eventually did find there, somebody pointed out to me on our blog, the main page of our website or blog at noxorchaos.com has become ground zero for discussing the merits between single high-res versus double high-res tile engines. Yeah. And somebody eventually, the discussion's been going on for like a year and a half, and somebody eventually posted a link to a double high-res tile engine. And I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. You know, this is the artifact from the past. And so I went and checked it out, and a lot of the questions in my mind were answered just by seeing it. And it was, I don't remember the game offhand. I wish I did. But it was really cool. Fundamentally, a great work in and of itself. I mean, they pulled it off fundamentally. It was a double high res, fully functioning tile engine. Great, you know, the graphics were great as expected as double high res. And from sort of like an anthropological standpoint, I also noted the trade-offs. They stood out to me since I was in the midst of designing a single high res engine. And, you know, for example, features that advanced single high-res engines would typically have, like line-of-sight algorithms that hide what's behind walls and mountains, you know, that was not there. The animation of tiles, which in advanced single high-res engines is typically there, you know, water rippling around and, you know, players moving their player character or mobs, you know, moving various appendages. There was very little animation, and there were a couple other things as well I noticed. But essentially, what I felt good about the decision in the standpoint that I know that I would not have wanted to have given up those things in Nox or Chaos. So I was glad in the end that we won single high res. But it was really an interesting, you know, process of learning and examining those trade-offs. It was really interesting to discover that.
Yeah, and I think, well, double high-res is kind of notoriously, I mean, like, Apple graphics is ridiculous from the outset, but double high-res, as mm-hmm. I understand it, is, like, ridiculous, you know, on an extra dimension as well.
Yes.
And you're moving twice as many pixels, and, you know, so I can understand why, you know, you're using twice as much memory to hold the graphics, and so, yeah.
Yep, exactly right.
One thing which I just did really want to bring up at the end is it's being released for Windows and Mac platforms. How are you managing the playability on the modern platform? Because I believe you've got 8 floppy disks or floppy disk sides in the Apple release. What about for those who don't have a Apple II conveniently available to play the game? If we're going to play it on Windows, how's the playability managed?
Sure. And to make sure I haven't accidentally misstated something before, on the Windows and Mac platform, playability would be through an emulator. So it'll, you know, it's essentially going to work with the same disk images. Which, as you noted, would be 8 in total, since 4 double-sided floppies. And, you know, it is an option, of course, you know, in an emulator for somebody to, you know, kind of flop the disk images in and out. However, the good news is that's not necessary because Nox Archaeus does support real and emulated hard drives that nice. Have the ProDOS operating system installed. So for somebody playing on a Mac or a PC, all they need to do is have their emulator set up with a hard drive, and you know the Nox disk images would you know just get copied onto the hard drive, and away they go. No disk flipping, none of that necessary. And along that same line, for example, somebody had a CFFA card in their Apple IIe, or you know they would be able to do the same and install Nox Archaeus right on the CFFA, and no more disk flipping, and of course cut down on the I/O times as well. It would be a very definitely a much faster experience on real Apple hardware to play Nox Archaeus off of the CFFA card. That actually touches on an interesting point that I really wanted to hit relating to the whole modern development of retro RPGs and you know kind of the contrasting approaches that have been taken to it. And with Nox Archaeus, we deliberately set out to optimize it to real floppy disk play. And essentially, while we're trying to push the frontier, and we have, you know, with new features, using more of the machine, we don't add the features to the game unless they play test well on the real floppy version. And, you know, for example, if the disk load is not acceptable on a real floppy disk, you know, to execute, you know, some kind of a feature, you know, we don't put it in. And so from that standpoint, we feel like we're able to, you know, really fairly accurately explore, you know, what the limits of the machine are, since, you know, we're really expanding off of the baseline that existed in the 80s before things like the CFFA came out. You know, that's kind of really just a personal, you know, preference in terms of, you know, how I wanted to approach the project. But other RPGs like Unknown Realm have taken a different approach, which honestly I didn't even really think about, that I found pretty fascinating. With, I think, as Paul mentioned, they have that custom cartridge in the Commodore, which brings with it faster I/O times than the cartridges would have had in the 1980s, substantially faster. And as a result, they can introduce gameplay features that you know just would not have been practical. And to benchmark it, I recall them saying that the entire game boots in like 2 seconds. So that was a pretty significant game there, and it enables them to, I believe, this is my own, you know, kind of from the sidelines assessment of it, use the cartridge as essentially a giant RAM disk. And by having, you know, just this huge amount of RAM available, because the cartridge is fast enough to basically be a RAM disk, you know, there's a lot of interesting features that they're able to do. Like, for example, they have NPCs traveling between towns. And not just like, you know, they might show up in a different town. Nox Archaeus is actually, we're likely going to be able to do that, where you bump into an NPC in a town and talk to him about something, and we flip a game state flag after you talk to him, and then maybe you're in a castle later on, and oh, lo and behold, that NPC is there because it detects the game state flag was flipped. In Unknown Realm, they've actually got it so the player can observe the NPC walking between one town to the next as they're going about their journey, like on the outdoor, you know, surface map. And I'm not exactly sure how they're doing it, but if I were to speculate, I think that it's probably taking a different approach to pathfinding that leverages that, you know, super fast cartridge, in the sense that really there's two approaches to pathfinding and getting an NPC from one point to another. You can either have an algorithm that sort of crawls around the tile map and figures it out, which uses a lot of speed, also a fair amount of memory, but definitely very speed intensive. Way too speed intensive to have you know, sort of long distance pathfinding going on a 6502 chip. But the other way to do it is just hard code the XY coordinates between point A and point B. And if you got enough RAM, you can do that.
Right.
So I think that may be what they're doing. Maybe the Unknown Realms folks will write into the show and correct me on this. I'd be very curious to know, but I suspect that's probably how they're getting the NPCs from one town to the next, where the player can actually observe it, is perhaps through some hard-coded coordinates that are very RAM-intensive but are possible through the fast I.O. times on their awesome custom cartridge.
Although hopefully it doesn't lead to huge intertown escort missions, which would be super annoying.
yeah, you could almost get into, you know, some civilization, Sid Meier's Civilization-like features there. You know, you're escorting merchant caravans from one place to the next. You know, it's a
new version of Desert Bus.
But little NPCs keep wandering away.
Yeah, follow that NPC. Yeah.
Now, before we go on, though, we've talked about the Kickstarter a bit, and of course we're going to have a link in the show notes to the Kickstarter for Noxocast. So if you're interested in the game, obviously it's going to be available for download, but if you want to get yourself a box and all the cool stuff that's been talked about on other podcasts and things, but there are, at least we can say, we can jump in with at least something new here, which are there are newly released tiers to entice those who might want to get something special along with their game. So Mark, do you want to talk a bit about like the new stuff that's been released on the Kickstarter recently that those of us who are very, very keen, I have already jumped in the Kickstarter, but pitch me on, what can I upgrade my Kickstarter pledge to? What are the new things that somebody interested in the game can sign up to receive?
And actually, maybe I'll also jump in and say, go ahead and give a quick overview of what's below that too, because it's quite possible that somebody listening to this won't have already heard this before. So,
sure, absolutely. As you can imagine, we're really excited about the Kickstarter. It's kind of bringing to a culmination a lot of the cool stuff that we've been working on with physical feelies to go along with the game, such as a full-color game box, fabric map, printed manual, and artifacts that connect to the storyline in-game, all done with professional artwork. And as Carrington mentioned, we've also got some new tiers that we've rolled out. Some of the original tiers allowed players to get naming rights to some objects in game, and there are still a couple of those left. Those are almost sold out, though. I think the couple that are left are name a suit of armor and name a waterfall, but the rest have all sold out. And because they were so popular, as Carrington noted, we added some new tiers, and the new tiers fall into three categories: crafter, cartography, and the master trio. And the crafter tiers basically give the player backer the opportunity to craft their own NPC or mob. And the crafting is done in the sense of they get to name the NPC or mob. In the case of the NPC, they get to provide input on the conversation text of the NPC, what the NPC's personality is, and basically other characteristics of how the NPC will fit into the world, what kind of location they want the NPC to be in, those sorts of things. Additionally, they will get the opportunity to do a kind of a describe what they would like their NPC or mob to look like, and that description will be rendered by one of our artists and included in the Noxarchaeus manual. And the 8-bit version of that NPC or mob will also be, to the degree possible, an 8-bit, influenced by, sort of that concept description as well. For the cartography tiers, these are great for a player that really wants to, kind of design part of the map world. And there's a number of different ways that can be done. There's islands. There are crypts and a couple of other, different, nooks and crannies in the Noxarchaeus world where the player is actually, basically given a small little tile set and a blank slate of 100 tiles on the map, where they can, you know, I'll decide what do they want their island to look like, or what do they want their crypt to look like. And something that we hope will be exciting to people that really get into the map designing. And there's also three tiers that I referred to before as the Master Trio. It's the Knight of the Realm, Archmage of the Realm, and Master Thief of the Realm. And these three masters are in service to the two Lords of the Realm, the Lord of the North and the Lord of the South. And they're actually NPCs in the game. The Lords are, and also the Knight, Thief, and Archmage of the Realm are also are NPCs, or what we call elite NPCs in the game. And so players that back those tiers, they get to have input into the name, conversation, text, personality of those elite NPCs, and additionally have input into some special weapons and treasure that are associated with those NPCs, which will be hidden in a secret location in the game that theoretically could be discovered by anybody, but there will be no clues in-game to it. The backers of those tiers would get the clues to find the special treasure through a custom map, the fabric map that comes with the game. They would get a custom version of the fabric map that actually has some clues to where this treasure is located. And that would kind of give some general clues. And then there's also a charred envelope that has some more specific clues to the treasure location that comes with those tiers as well. So it sets up a situation where the player backer can try to find it on their own entirely, or, you know, they can look at the map and kind of see generally here's, you know, where they should go, and then try to figure it out. Or they can go to the point of, once they follow the clues on the map, open up this charred envelope that would then give sort of a final layer of clues more specifically to where the treasure is hidden. And this all ties into the storyline. There's a reason that these three elite NPCs, that their treasure is not in their possession anymore, and that it's off, you know, hidden somewhere. And that's all going to tie into the storyline. And, you know, this becomes an opportunity for the player to really, you know, kind of role play these elite NPCs and get into, you know, role playing the storyline in a very immersive way.
Excellent.
That is super awesome. Those are some really creative and very enticing tiers.
Yeah, I think I would be interested to, you know, talk to you again later just to see what you think of how it went, you know, like what you've learned about Kickstarter when it's all over. But this seems like a good campaign.
Yeah.
I see also that you had Lord British's seal of approval here, which is pretty cool.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't say enough how that has made my day. Lord British accepted box set number one of Noxor Cast. And as you mentioned, you know, you know, come out and said how much that he looked forward to exploring the realm of Noxor Chaos. And, you know, he just can't beat that when the king himself, you know, says those kind words. So we've been really excited about that, and would be happy to talk to you, as you suggested at some point, about, you know, kind of the lessons learned. The Kickstarter has definitely been a learning experience. It's certainly the first one that I've done. I fortunately, you know, have some experience in the kind of the world of cloud computing, you know, through my day job. So that, you know, that has helped some in terms of, you know, just being comfortable operating in that kind of environment. But Kickstarter is its own very special thing. And,
right.
You know, it has definitely been a crash course here for us, but we're doing our best.
Well, and it looks like, so right now it's got, as we are recording, it's got 26 days to go, and it's about a quarter of the way there, so there's still plenty of time, but if, you know, as I'm saying those words, but everyone should go check this out.
Yes, please do. We really need your help to push this one over the finish line. It was a strong start for an Apple II game, and, you know, with everyone's help here in not just the Apple II community, but the retro community in general. You know, it's doable with your help. You know, please check us out and back the Kickstarter. And if I don't have an Apple II, you know, play on your Mac and PC. I really think you'll enjoy our game.
Excellent. Yeah, that's, you know, so this whole discussion has been a bit, you know, kind of Apple II centric, just because this game is about the Apple II, and we were all of us at Kansas Fest, you know, where you did your presentation about this and stuff, and you know, there are other, and unfortunately I'm not as familiar with the other ones. You know, you mentioned Unknown Realm is being, you know, developed for the Commodore, but you know, we periodically have mentions of new games that come out on various platforms, and I think you know, it's neat that development is ongoing. There was one thing that I wanted to mention. I don't know if we put this in, you know, back at the time, but there, you mentioned about using, like the Commodore, whatever it is, Unknown Realm, is taking advantage of sort of like a new kind of cartridge that's fast enough to be treated almost as a RAM disk. And there's actually a pretty cool, I think it just was from earlier this year, TRS-80 video player for model 1, 3, and 4, which makes use of the FRED, you know, flash hard drive emulator, but because the transfer speed is so fast, it actually can play video on a model 1, which is like, you know, crazy. But so that's I mean, that's kind of a neat thing to do too, although you know, it feels like there's a line somewhere, and I'm not sure exactly where it is, where, like, if you put a whole, you know, Raspberry Pi inside the cartridge, you know, to do your, you know, the plotting of your NPC routes, then it's conceivable that's getting a little far away from retro.
Yeah, I agree with you there, that at a certain point, if a retro machine is kind of buffed with, you know, too much modern technology, at a certain point, well, why not just, you know, design a modern game, and do it in, you know, with a sort of a retro skin. And, you know, where that line is, I agree that there is one. I'm not sure where it is. I don't think Unknown Realms crossed it. I think they did a really good job at essentially, you know, taking the most annoying aspects out of 8-bit gameplay, and i.e. the load times, I think.
particularly sensitive to this on the Commodore.
Yeah. I think they did a really good job in that. And while there is a line there somewhere, I think they stayed, you know, inside of it. And I really wish them well on their project. I'm not sure when their release date is going to be. I haven't checked in on them in a while. It was originally late this year, so hopefully they're still on target with that, and if they're not, I'm sure they're working real hard to deliver it to their backers as soon as possible.
Yeah, and I'm definitely of, you know, like, several minds on the question of, like, using new fancy hardware, because as a kind of like an Apple enthusiast myself, you know, like, one of the things that this computer had going for it was slots. You know, you could expand it with things, and we can expand it with new fancy stuff now, but still using the old architecture. So that's also this, I don't know, it's a fun hobby. I guess we can all agree on that. But, okay, it's conceivable that we should move on from the host topic, since there are other things to talk about. But we will definitely have links to the NoxRKS page, NoxRKS Kickstarter, there, and the TRS-80 video on Unknown Realm as well. Anyone else want to say anything further on this?
Can't wait for the game.
Thank you.
No, I just say, yeah, I agree with Carrington. Can't wait for the game, and I just love the fact that there are people and companies out there who are still providing new software for our retro platforms. So thank you very much, Mark.
And I've put my money where my mouth is, and I have backed one of the tiers, and I cannot wait, and it's awesome, and other people should do it as well, because I want the fancy boxes to come out.
Thank you so much for your support and kind words. I hope you all have as much fun playing NoxRKS as we're having making it.
All right. Move back on to the sort of normal path that we traverse on RCR, and move to listener feedback. I'll just say a couple of things that we got. Andy wrote in with the observation that we tend to, I guess this sort of fits in a little bit with what we were talking about. We tend to be using like modern terminology, But it might be interesting to consider the terminology of the past when things were new, you know, when it wasn't email, but it was electronic mail, and there were cellular phones. He'd been looking at some sort of computing dictionary from the past, and that's what sort of sparked that. And I do remember seeing these little, like, glossaries and things, which can be somewhat amusing. Although I'm not going to go back to calling it electronic mail.
I am.
And they're mobiles.
Yeah. That's right. They're not cellular phones at all.
They're mobiles. They're not cell phones. They're mobiles.
Right.
I'd like to go back to the fight over whether or not email should have a hyphen in it.
Yeah.
And
internet should be capitalized.
I would also like to resume the fight against email being pluralized as emails. I'm willing to take up both of those fights again. I barely was willing to stop those fights.
Yeah, email is like soup. You know, cut it in half, it's still email. Twice as much, it's still email. Anyway, okay. So, another bit of feedback. Santo posted on the Facebook groups saying that we talked, I think, in the previous episode, maybe a couple ago, about the K-Pro 2000 that was on eBay, but it was sort of split into several different auctions. I don't entirely understand what happened. It seemed like the battery was being sold in one auction, the manuals in another, the main unit in one auction, but it didn't have a keyboard because the keyboard had separately been sold before. But it seems like Santo has wound up with everything but the power supply. So it's a kind of a happy ending, I guess, that everything kind of is back together in one home, even if it was a kind of a dumb auction. So,
yep. Cool.
But anyway, so that was good. So good news for that. And I still think these are very cool looking computers. I had not come across them before that. But okay. Anyway, so moving on to items of interest and news. Carrington, you have the first one.
Ken Gagne is sometimes on this
yep.
show.
Yep.
But he is not today. And yet, we will mention him because he has launched, or really relaunched, the Retro Roundup. So Retro Roundup is a website that was, it started by Kevin Savitz way back in 2005. And I remember it from ages and ages ago. And so I think Kevin had approached Ken about, you know, Kevin didn't have time to keep it up, and like maybe Ken could take over the mantle of head roundupper and get it relaunched. And that has now happened. Ken gave a talk, or one of the lightning talks, at Kansas Fest this year, at Kansas Fest 2017, and announced the relaunch of it. And it is indeed fully relaunched. So I'll have a link in the show notes. And it's a great place to go. It's basically an aggregator. So it aggregates RSS feeds and YouTube things, and blogs, and a whole bunch of different stuff. So if you're interested in retro things in general, it's a nice way to go and say, what's the new... It's going to be really handy for us coming up with all these things.
Yeah.
So super handy if you have to do a podcast every couple of weeks and look at what's new in retro stuff. So hooray for that. But also, if you're just interested, you want to see like kind of what's new in general in the retro world, it's a one-stop shop for that. And the nice thing is it has categories like checkable things on the side. So you might say, what's new, but I'm only interested, like show me stuff that is related to the Tandy, or only show me things that are in the news or just from vendors or something like that, just arcade things. So it's nice if you want to get a broad look. It's also nice if you want to dive in and just look at something like what's new in a particular subset. Mm-hmm. So it's well done. It's nicely put together. It is, of course, being a Ken thing, powered by WordPress, because he is the WordPress guy. And he still uses the old logo, which I really, really like, because it's from the Stampede game from Atari 2600. And I like the logo very much. I'm glad it stuck with that. And it is it's a good site. So we'll have a link in the show notes.
Lots of representation of the BBC Micro in these early things. I don't know.
Yeah, but if the micro's if you want your thing of choice to be on here more often, then you got to have your thing of choice have new stuff about it. Go out there and put out, and the Apple II is going to totally dominate, of course, but go BBC Micro for now.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I also want to say that speaking of Ken, a friend of the show, host of the show, Ken Cagney, and Sabriel Maston have also launched a new podcast, Transporter Lock, which is about the new Star Trek show, Star Trek Discovery, which, Paul, you pointed out, Star Trek Discovery, STD. So that's great. Now, I'm sure there's 1,000 podcasts about that one, but I've only listened to this. I've listened to the first episode, and I quite liked it. Mm-hmm. It, of course, starts with they're going to go where no podcast has gone before. I'm sure all of the podcasts about the new
Star Trek exactly there.
Went exactly to there. But this is a good one. I dug it. I like the rapport between the hosts. And I can say that because Ken's not on here, so I can throw him some compliments instead of tearing him down. And so well done, Ken. Smart episode to not be on. But it's a good podcast. So we will have a link to that in the show notes as well.
Well, speaking of compliments to Ken, I just want to say I really think he's done a great job with Retro Roundup. And one of the coolest things I think about the site is that you can select your topics. It's really a personalized feed that you then get through email, about retro computing, as well as, of course, you can go on the site anytime and, look at what's out there. But I'm not aware of anything like that out there in the retro world, so I thought that was pretty neat.
I agree.
The Vintage is the New Old does something that's a little bit like that, although there's more. It's lower volume and higher editorial content at that. So, but yeah, it's quite interesting. Actually, I was a little surprised to see that I posted something and suddenly it was here. oh yeah, I guess my feed's on there as well.
Yeah, once it picks up the feed, it's there. It's and the nice thing is it holds on to. I mean, it's got the 1 megahertz field. It holds on to old feeds. Mm-hmm. So if something kind of drops off the radar and then they publish something, bingo, it's going to be on there. So that's pretty cool. Yeah, but Vintage is the New Old. We should link to that as well because that's also a very good site and a site that I frequent to find out what's new in the retro world.
All right. Let's see. And I've also listened to the episode 0 of Transporter Lock, and I haven't been very good at keeping up with Star Trek, but I'm gonna try this and I'll listen to the podcast. Okay, Michael, you have the next thing, Computer Weekly at TNMOC.
Yes, this is one of these great-to-see articles. So what we have here is Computer Weekly has donated 104 volumes of back copies of its publication, Computer Weekly, and that started in 1966. So this is a great historical archive. So what I especially like about this is that we have the publishers who are providing hard copy of their archive so that it can be digitized and made available initially to researchers and historians, but the intent of the National Museum of Computing over in the UK is to actually provide that information to all visitors of the National Museum of Computing. So you have people who are doing a lot of scanning of magazines and newsletters and things themselves, sometimes not particularly concerned about copyright and release issues, but it's always great to see a publisher who is stepping up and making their whatever they've got in their archive available for future and current readers and supplying it as a historical archive, especially a weekly issue like this. Shows the evolution of computing. There's great little takeaways there that they're looking at an early issue of Computer Weekly, and they say there's a job advertisement for a 23 to 28 year old male programmer, annual salary of £735.
Must work shirtless. It's so weird.
Interesting.
That entry.
Yeah, interesting on many levels. That now they're specifically looking for an age group and male. The salary is interesting as well, but that it's how things have evolved. That's not the sort of demographic information that you basically go for these days, or even post up. So it's also good for that sociological history of computing, how things have changed in the 40-something years that they've been publishing. So I'm sure there'll be great reference material in the advertisements that are in there for hardware and software, and also on the articles, people of the day, projects, everything that's going on. Would really love to be able to get on right now to look at that, but I don't think I quite fall into their category of researcher, but looking forward to it.
One question I have is, I don't know if you can answer this, or it doesn't seem to be mentioned on the TeenMok site. They're referring to them as beautifully bound copies, 104 volumes, like bound up. And if they're going to be digitized, is the idea that they're going to rip these open and scan them? Like they're bound, yeah. Even in the photo, it's a photo of something where that wouldn't be easy to scan unless you start cutting it open.
No, that got me interested as well. And as much as I would love the scans to be of highest quality as possible, I'm hoping that there is an open book scanner that can take that newsletter. I'm just looking at the site, so that's seems to be bigger than a tabloid. It's not really a broadsheet. I suppose it could be a broadsheet issue back then. But yes, I'm hoping they don't have to rip them apart. But if the binding can be replaced, then maybe that's the avenue they'll have to take. But I don't think they were really planning ahead when they were binding them up. It was more for, well, here is a physical hard copy of all of our issues. What's the best way to present those? And in that case, they have it in 104 volumes. So it would be interesting to see how it all eventuates.
I think it's pretty wild that this was, like, I had no idea that this went back to the 60s. I mean... That's
Yeah, I was aware of it in the late 80s.
Right.
But yes, to go right back to the mid 60s, that does really make it a very interesting historical resource.
Yeah, I didn't even recognize the name really until I saw the logo, and then I thought, oh yeah, okay, of course. You know, Computer Weekly, just, you know, sans serif red letters.
Yep.
That's I know what that is, but still, it seemed like I'd never seen it before the 80s. So
yeah, it'd be interesting to see also inside the articles. There'll be photography and whatnot. That's one of the things I look forward to eventually being able to see, because how much of those and maybe the pictures, the photographs are available. I know a lot of newspapers make their photo archive available. Be interesting to see what kind of photo archive Computer Weekly has to go back with their actual issues. Because there'd be quite a lot of information that can be gleaned from those photos as well as the articles.
Yeah, it's really nice that they're actually... Like, I can sort of see a publisher like this saying... we don't have the resources to scan these and make these available and whatever, but it's nice that they're willing to say, if someone else will do the work, here's the stuff to do it with.
Mm. So. Along with the rights to actually present that back up into the greater public and not just the research community.
Okay. I have the next one. And this is from Ken Sheriff's blog. I forget when this was posted. It was not too long ago, but, it's called Examining a Vintage RAM Chip, I Find a Counterfeit with an Entirely Different Die Inside. And it's actually a super interesting little look at kind of like reverse engineering from a very detailed photo of the chip die, what it was supposed to be. So the beginning of this story was basically that someone had been doing, I don't know how you actually do these. I don't think it's x-rays. It might be sort of like, you know, removing the top with acid and using microscopes to take these photos, but a very detailed photo of a chip die that was called static RAM. This was posted by somebody on Twitter, and Ken looked at this and said, "Wait, I just analyzed something that should be in the same family, and it looks nothing like this at all." the chip was labeled as being a TTL RAM chip, and so he dug into it and, you know, looked at the photo, tried to figure out, like, all right, well, so what are all these things doing? You know, so he isolated where the power is, found some ROMs and resistor networks and stuff like this. And, more different resistors than he would have expected in a RAM chip at all. And so it was fairly clear that this was a counterfeit, first of all, you know, that it was labeled as a RAM chip, but it was not a RAM chip. Which is interesting in and of itself. But he actually went through and tried to figure out, all right, well, so what is it then if it's not a RAM chip? Because it's something, right? It's not just random paths. And he, you know, sort of worked out that it seems to be some sort of digital to analog conversion, and kind of worked out like what kind of conversion it was trying to do. And, you know, I hate to almost give away the punchline, but it turns out that what it was a DTMF decoder.
Like for a touchtone phone. It's bonkers that this is like, I found this story fascinating. It hit Twitter and I was like, wait, what's going on here? Like, this was crazy. I had no idea that like silicone counterfeiting was this widespread, but it turns out like IC counterfeiting is supposed to be like 15% of the chips out there are counterfeit or something. It's crazy.
Yeah. And I mean, like it's not even close what this thing is. I mean, like it's, I don't really understand why it goes that direction. It seems like, wouldn't a DTMF decoder be like more complex? But anyway, it's super interesting. Both to, you know, you sort of get an insight into like how these things actually work. How, you know, like I don't know very much about chip design, but I know a lot more now having read this.
Yeah, it's bizarre, and it's a chip that he was saying it sells for like $1. It's a $1 chip, and yet somebody goes to the effort of counterfeiting it and making a thing that couldn't possibly work. And it's just the whole thing is insane. The whole story is insane.
But the whole concept of you know, grabbing a pin-compatible IC and then effectively re-screen printing on, and as you said, it's a dollar chip. So the margins in it, you must have to be shipping a volume of these to actually make it worth your while. So it makes you wonder, sort of like, how seriously tied into a manufacturing, distribution, fabricator environment that these counterfeits are coming out of. Now, if you came across a bag full of chips, you know, to go to the trouble of, if they're blank, screen printing on to then sell them, or if, cleaning them off and re-screen printing the ID on there, that's a lot of effort. And it really, as I said, it only really would seem to pay off in a volume situation. But as I said, this is there, 10-15% of the chips out there are counterfeit, and makes me a bit worried about some future purchases. So far, I've been lucky with some of my purchases from OS, maybe I'm going to have to restrict my purchases through electronics vendors that I can select. Say, hey, I plugged this in, it's not working. Oh, we've had a few people there.
One of the neat things about this, that I'd never seen before, or at least never occurred to me, because I'm a software guy, not a hardware guy, was they could look at the die photos of this, and there were a bunch of little matrices, and that he recognized were ROM, and you can look at them and tell that there are a whole bunch of little 4-bit words, like with the data on the left and a little decoder on the right. So by just looking at the photo, you could tell where the ones and the zeros were, and so you could like read the ROM from a photo of the ROM.
Yeah, reading the
ROM.
I was
like, well, that's cool. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Well, it is read only.
The whole thing was very fascinating.
It's wild, yeah.
I was way out of my depth, even reading the article, though. Like, I don't understand half of this stuff. I skimmed through the article. I found it fascinating. I got to the end and said, well, I know what's happened here is it's been counterfeited. Okay, that's kind of my takeaway, because there's a lot of stuff in the world of these chips that I do not understand.
And then to add to the article, sort of like, oh, and perhaps I should explain how a touch-tone phone works. So like, okay, I found this is the chip. Oh, and by the way, this is how it's used. I love tangents.
Yeah, no, I think this, even though it was... You know, it's quite high level or very, very low level stuff. There's enough sort of like pointers to how you, like, it's not entirely opaque. He introduces things, and if you wanted to go search them out, you now have the terminology to do so. Mm. And, you know, so you don't, even though I felt like this was over my head, I still didn't feel like I was locally lost, even if I was globally lost in some way. So, yeah, super interesting. Super interesting. All right, let's see. Carrington, you have the next thing.
It's a cool thing. It's a cool thing, too. So, Cast your mind back to summer of 1982. The ColecoVision came out. I never had one, but I had some friends who had it, and I played Donkey Kong on it. It was kind of neat. And to the point of this story, it was powered by a Z80 running at 3.58 megahertz. Now, next year, 1983, Sega releases their first video game console, the SG-1000, also powered by a Z80 running at 3.58 megahertz. Now, why do those things matter? Well, because there is separately, currently, a CPM card that exists for the Apple II. And it's created and put out, and you can get it through, like a guy who makes this stuff. Ian Kim. Yeah, so anyway, he's got the CPM card, the Turbo 7 card, and that's been out for a bit. Well, there's a new daughter card he's created that you can solder to that, or you can buy them as a pair if you don't have either. If you got yourself the CPM Turbo 7 card, you can now pick up his VDP 1000 Plus card, which is a VDP option. Basically, it's a video card. So when you combine these two, you've got yourself essentially the guts that would be needed to power both the processor and the video now for both the Sega SG-1000 and the ColecoVision, because you got yourself the CPM stuff, you've got the Zilog Z80 running at the correct speed, and so the processing is done by that card. The video output now is picked up by the VDP 1000. So this gives you a card you can plug into an Apple II and now launch and play natively old Sega and ColecoVision video games. It's completely bonkers. It basically is using barely any of the Apple II. It's just like, say, hey, I can host this. And you throw in enough other things into a slot and you give yourself a whole other video machine. It's totally crazy. So I watched a bunch of videos of people playing ColecoVision games on their Apple II, and it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it seems like it's kind of obvious / simple and mind-blowing at the same time. You know, I don't know why this is so weird to me, but I think of ColecoVision as like an entirely separate kind of beast. And I certainly didn't think of it as a Z80 totally. Thing.
Mm.
No, not at all. And one of the weirdest things is I watched a video of somebody playing Lode Runner. So it's an Apple II and you're playing Lode Runner, but they're playing the SG-1000 version of Lode Runner. And I'm looking at it like, this game is all wrong. It's the wrong aspect ratio, the wrong color. What is happening? And that's what led me down this rabbit hole, because I'm looking at a video of an Apple II playing clearly the wrong version of Lode Runner natively. And it's just crazy and amazing. So I have a link to the show notes. These are all things that are currently available, so you can buy them if you want. If you've got the Turbo 7 card already, you just need to pick up the Dada card, in which case you'll have to solder them together. But they're also now available as a duo, and he sells this stuff through eBay. So it's really weird, but I expect somebody's going to be hosting this stuff at Kansas Fest next year.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Speaking of soldering, see the transition I tried? Michael, you have the next thing.
Well done.
Yeah, this one is a great little find. So it came up in my feed. So this is the PC Retro Motherboard Kit. So you too can assemble your own IBM clone computer. So what I like about this is that it's a reproduction of the IBM PC 5150 motherboard. So you get the board, you get a bag of all your components, hopefully no counterfeit ones included, and documentation and everything that you need to basically build a 64K 1982 IBM PC. Now, when you click on the link to go to the website, it takes you back, I think, it has a very early 90s feel about the website. It's, how shall we say, static?
Under construction.
No. Yeah, but so I was a bit concerned at first. So, like, how current is this? Okay, it's pay by PayPal, so, you know, it's relatively recent. So I thought, I'll pop off an email. So I'm happy to report that I was confirmed by email that the PC Retro Kit, there is about He says he's got about components to provide about 50 more of these to interested people who wish to purchase them. And there's all these other bits and pieces that go with it. So there's diagnostic ROM kits, there's extra memory. As I said, the machine will work with the supplied 64K, but it has additional banks, and you can purchase additional chips and have a 256K machine. So if this is something that you would like to play with and get the soldering iron out and go at it, again, it's all, to me, large-scale componentry. So none of this, I can't see any surface-mounted stuff on here. It is looks like quite a, I would say, a medium-plus difficulty. It's just going through methodically and getting it all done and using a fine-tip soldering iron, you should be right. But it's good to see that there are kits like this that are available.
One of the only downsides to this is you don't get the big case, like the 5150. What's fun about it is the big, giant metal case. And frankly, frequently beat up ones go on eBay for less than the cost of this kit. So that's one of the hard things. It's a hard sell. I mean, you'll get it new, you'll understand it all, and that's really cool. But if you're going to drop, you know, $190 or something on this kit, that same money will buy you a actual IBM 5150 with the case from back in the day.
Yeah, you're right. But I do love this as a kit. So for me, this is more the experience of assembling it, sort of like back in the day when you would buy a Sinclair ZX80 as a kit, and you'd solder it all together, hook it all up, go back, take a few bits apart, re-solder it back together, and after a few iterations, you'd have a working machine. I love that in this you've got something that is an early DOS machine that you would be able to put together again as a project. And
see, that's where the metaphor falls down, because I made a ZX80 back in the day, and even when it was done, would we call it them a working machine?
Right.
That was about the most useless computer ever. So
working as in operational.
Yes, but not actually useful for anything in particular. But okay, I see what you're saying, though. I do agree with that.
So yeah, I think I'd rather have the this as a kit than a ZX80 as the kit, because I think you could actually do a bit more with an early DOS machine than you could do with the Sinclair, even if it did have that little sci-fi wedge.
And I should correct myself here. I just hit eBay, and most of the 5150s are going for like $400 or $500. So I have vastly underestimated the cost of picking one of those up. So I'd like to take back what I said earlier. Turns out,
About those opinions of yours, you did say earlier that you don't believe in them.
Mostly, I disagree with me.
Yeah. Well, there we are. So we can agree that we disagree with your agreement.
Agree to disagree.
It's true that the case, having a case is really the sort of iconic part. But the other thing too is that I can't decide if this is unfair or not. But I sort of feel like this, like, you still need more stuff for this. Like, my recollection of the 5150 is that there wasn't, like, I don't know, how do you get video out of this thing? I think you need a card.
You need
right?
a card.
Like,
yes.
So.
The counterfeit cards are really cheap.
Right. So unlike the ZX80 or, you know, like the Apple II or whatever, you need more stuff for this.
That's when they make their real money.
That's right. That's it.
Now that you got the kit, mate, nice kit you have here. It'd be a shame if no video happened to it.
Oh, it's cool.
Harrington's our Apple II mafia here, I guess.
Exactly.
That's right.
No, I always thought I'd be more of like a feng shui mafia. Like, it's a nice house you got here. Shame if somebody puts some running water in your money corner.
I'm gonna put a hallway door right at the end of the house. Yeah.
Oh no.
It's funny. Yeah. Like, I don't know if it's my own perspective or whether it's, you know, it is actually a general you know, truth about the kind of like the retro hobby, that it seems like IBM PCs are not super well represented. You know, like it, I think it might, I sort of feel like it might be that there isn't a lot of nostalgia, because at the 5150 point, these were business machines. And you know, the people who like the Windows games and that sort of thing aren't thinking about the 5150. They're thinking about the, you know, the Dell box or whatever. Right. So, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I feel sort of bad that we don't include more of these, but then, you know, at the same time, they don't come up.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm sure that there are ISA cards out there that will actually work in this. So I suppose I should go back into my collection of old bits. I've got some boxes well buried at the back of the bunker here, and I'm sure I'd have cards in there as well for it. I think it's great that it's available. I love that it's a do-it-yourself kit. And,
are you going to do it?
I've got too many already. I still haven't got round to doing my Pi Pi 8, in its little blinking light case. I think I should, get it done before I, get anything else. Because everyone needs their own, PDP 8 to play with.
Well, and after we get done with the gift idea, I'll have another one. Another thing to do, so.
Oh, you're too kind.
Good segue.
Except that I still have one more thing to talk about.
Bad segue.
Oh, I can delete that.
So I'll say the last thing, which is actually relatively quick. And I'm not sure, we might have talked about this before at some point, but Tony wrote to us in listener feedback at some point, pointing out a link to a site called Easy6502, and it is at skildrick.github.io. We'll have a link in the show notes. But what it is basically a 6502 textbook of the sort that, you know, we all are probably kind of familiar with, like, you know, learn assembly language 6502. And there, you know, there's many, many of these for all the computers that use the 6502. And they're often relatively hard to get through. So this is another such textbook. But what's kind of cool about this is that it has sort of like embedded throughout little 6502, you know, assembler runner emulators. You know, so it says like, here's how this works. You know, here's some code. You can just hit run and see what it does and play with it. And, you know, it sort of walks you through with little bits of sample code and an assembler and debugger right there that you can play with. So I think if you, in a modern context, wanted to learn 6502, as many people say they want to do, at least, this is a good way to do it. It looks pretty cool. I have possibly hubristically, I believe I know the 6502, and so I have not gone through this.
Mark will now quiz you.
Yeah, right. All right, how many cycles is this if it jumps over a page boundary? But I think this is really kind of a nice way to learn it, because it's not intimidating. You don't have to. You can work on this little steps at a time and see exactly what each little thing is doing. And I would suggest checking it out if you are even at all interested in learning this.
I dig this as well, yeah. And it's changed since we talked about it, I think, ages ago. But I have a question for you, Mark. Since you're on the show, I'll put you on the spot. You came to the Knox project, or came up with it, before you were really super versed in programming on the 6502, like assembler. Wasn't this the thing that you kind of did and learned assembly language? Am I correct? Remembering it that way?
Yeah, you're correct. Prior to that, on the Apple II, I had tons of AppleSoft Basic experience and actually tried to write a tile engine in AppleSoft Basic once, and I later found out the principle behind it was correct, but of course the language was wrong and ran out of memory, didn't work.
So then I have a question for you. Did you use something like this? Like, how did you bootstrap yourself? Like, what tools, websites or books or whatever, did you use to become the 6502 master that you are now?
Well, thank you for the compliment, even if it's perhaps slightly exaggerated. The book that I found was Using Assembly Language by Randy Hyde. And I had tried to learn assembly language when I was growing up in the 80s. And, you know, looking back on it, I realized the problem was I never had the right book, and books were hard to come by at that time. And my high school library had like one, and it was not a beginner's book. It was intermediate or advanced. It assumed that you knew what an assembler was and that you had one. And I sat there at the AppleSoft prompt typing in, you know, like LDA and wondering why I kept getting the syntax error and what am I doing wrong? Because, you know, and that's all you know, that, you know, you boot up the Apple and you can type in AppleSoft Basic. That's, you know, how you think that all programming languages work, or at least that was my case. And so anyway, Using Assembly Language by Randy Hyde is what I sought out here in modern times, because what stood out to me is, well, it was designed to be a beginner's book, and it had examples in Liza. It was the particular assembler, and I typed in all the different examples that it had, basically front to cover on the book, and that was, you know, my immersion experience. And by the end of it, I can definitely say that I was definitely Googling cross assemblers and how do I set up one, and, you know, it was kind of fun and nostalgic to, you know, sit there at the actual Apple II and, you know, type out those examples. But you know, definitely was looking forward to you know, getting on something more modern to do the bulk of the coding.
Cool.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think this was a Datamost book, I think, right? There was a I sort of can almost picture this book.
It was indeed. You can probably picture it if you go to our show notes and find a link to the PDF.
Ah. Nice. It's always nice when things
just appear. Oh,
yeah,
look at that.
Nice.
And so, listeners, if you're interested in checking out that book, and you can become the next Mark II. Oh, Mark II.
Nice.
We will hook you up.
It can be done.
Yep. Pretty good, though, that I remembered it was Datamost, though, right?
Well done.
Thank you. All right. Let's move on to the vintage commercial. And now a word from our sponsor.
While Atari keeps trying to sell you new systems like the 5200, with ColecoVision you only need one system, because ColecoVision expands to give you a Super Action controller set with Super Action Baseball, a driving module with Turbo, an expansion module to play all Atari 2600 games, and only ColecoVision plugs into the Atom module to become the complete Atom computer system. So if you don't want to keep buying new systems, there's only one system to buy, ColecoVision. Sorry, Atari.
And we're back. Okay, so it is time for the host's retro computing gift idea, and I'm going to go for a relatively expensive one this time, the Altair Duino. So it's a mock-up of the Altair 8800. So it's the same kind of universe as this PiDP8 that we were mentioning before. It looks quite similar, but it's essentially an Altair 8800 being run on Arduino. So it's a kit that you can buy. It is inspired by the PiDP8. It says, you know, thank you to Oscar Vermeulen of Obsolescence Guaranteed. So the kit involves, I think it's a Arduino Due, which is running the actual code. There's a PC board that has LEDs and little toggle switches to be like the Altair 8800, and you can buy the kit. I think you can buy the kit for $128 if you want to just buy the bare everything, buy the Arduino Due yourself. If it costs $10 more to have a bamboo project box, which you probably want because it looks nice, and if you don't want to do any of this and you just want to have the thing on your desk, which at times I think maybe we should have done with the PiDP8, Michael.
Yeah.
But I saw one. Actually, somebody had one at the Kansas Fest.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've seen one assembled now.
It's good to know what mine will look like one of these days. But yes, sometimes right. I wish that I'd paid to have someone else enjoy putting it together.
Right, because I am looking forward to it, but you know, it could well be a retirement project for me at this point. So you can get the whole thing assembled for you for $250. So it's not, you know, couch change, but it's not too bad, and it looks very cool. So if you want to have the experience of, you know, having an Altair 8800 without the experience of having an empty bank account and you know, a hernia, then this is for you. It's at altairduino.com.
Which, I mean, well, that's one of the more pricey gifts maybe we've selected. Like, compared to, like, there's, like, an Altair clone out there, and I think it's, like, $600 or something. So this is a much more inexpensive way to get yourself an Altair-y kind of thing on your desk.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's true. So the altairclone.com, the Altair 8800 clone, full-sized, you know, really fancy replica is much more expensive. I think David Grealish has one of those, if I recall correctly.
Who's that guy? Was he ever on the show?
I sort of vaguely remember him. Hi, David, if you're listening.
Oh, my God, because we've been doing the show for how long now? I think we're coming up on 7 years,
it's coming
which
up
is insane.
On, yeah.
Soon we're going to have, like, episodes about ourselves being retro. Like, those early shows are now retro.
Nice. But, I think it'd be fun to have the full clone, although, I mean, like, I actually, at this point, I'm feeling very conservative about my space expenditures. So
someday we will all hear about Paul dying in an avalanche and people will think snow and we'll go, no, don't understand.
An avalanche of retro goodness. What a way to go.
Right, exactly. If I had to choose a way, actually, that probably wouldn't be the way, but
if I have to choose a way I'm going to die, it's going to be last.
Yes, right, exactly. Okay. So that's, after you're done, in recovering from buying the Altair Arduino, we can go to eBay. And Carrington, you have the first auction for us.
I'd also still like to begin with saying that you shouldn't buy stuff. Stop buying things. Okay, but that said, since I'm forced to pick something for the show, I'm picking what I think is kind of a silly and ridiculously priced thing, but it caught my eye. So it's The Witness, the game The Witness. Witness the quickness while I kick this. So The Witness, Infocom game. But for the Deck Rainbow, so it's a CPM version of the Infocom game, and what caught my eye is, of course, being a CPM thing, they got to take all the fun out of everything. So The Witness, the folio version of The Witness, is really fun because it's one of the early Infocom games that comes in super swell packaging. So it's a big thing. It's like a, it comes in like a folder, and it looks like an old magazine thing, and it's got lots of all the feelies and all the fun stuff. So when you hold an original Witness folio game, it's really neat and colorful and awesome. And what the Deck Rainbow version does is stick that inside a very boring box with a picture of what would be the cool box on the outside of it in a little tiny square to say, if you were on a more fun computer, if this wasn't a digital computer, your box would look like this. But instead, you get this one. So that really just tickles me. I think it's really funny. And, you know, the Deck Rainbow itself, we've talked about it on earlier shows, is a weird beast as it is because, if I recall, it comes with both a Z80 and an Intel 8088 in it. So it's both like a CPM and PC computer all in one. Kind of famous because that super sexist writer, Piers Anthony, was like a big proponent of it. So it probably comes with a, like a crazily sexist word processor or something. I don't know. but this is really all I know about the Rainbow. But I like the fact that this comes in a box that's been made to be as boring as possible. But once you open it up, it's got all the neat feelies and stuff inside it. So it is already opened, and it's $300, so it ain't cheap. There's one person watching. I'm pretty sure that's probably me, having watched it for this. Then I have no intention of dropping that kind of coin on this thing. But it's neat. So if you want a boring on the outside, fun on the inside version of The Witness, then Deck will hook you up.
It's pretty cool, though, to be able to see this. Like, you know, it's not, Infocom stuff is in general not super rare, but this, like, seeing it for the sort of more obscure platforms is.
Yeah.
I think I have a K Pro 2 version of something. Might even be this. Actually.
But, everyone's got The Witness.
Yeah. But, which, you know, that's also kind of cool. It's kind of, it's just sort of bizarre to see all of the same stuff, but with a little, you know, card that says, here's how you run it on the K-Pro.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So here you go. That's my choice.
Oh, and speaking of Infocom, Apple, you know, Apple, the maker of the iPhone, has just released iOS 11. And it part of the added benefits of moving to iOS 11 is that none of the 32-bit applications work anymore. and that includes the lost treasures of Infocom.
Infocom, which Kevin tweeted, I need that for the future. So it may, moving to iOS 11 may actually impact the future of our podcast, Kevin and I. And so eaten by a grue, Kevin's going to now take much longer to finish Zork 2 because of this, I think. Darn you, Apple.
It's annoying because, my impression is from, a little bit of looking into this, that it's really basically they have to open the thing, recompile it, and, send it to the App Store. That's probably about all it is. But
older games and stuff, they stop creating revenue, and people are like, I'm not going to bother. A bunch of old games that I really like are not compatible, including like Prince of Persia and Another World. But those ones have all announced that they're going to. Supposedly come out, but I think Lost Treasures is just now gone.
It might be, yeah. Flappy Bird, too, I think, is one among the ones that was going to go.
It's a thing, like, the difference between modern platforms, the stuff today it's not like people are going to be able to play these games. Everything's just going to vanish, partly because of stuff like this, partly because everything uses servers now for DRM, etc., and so there's not going to be an RCR equivalent for the kids growing up today when they're getting their nostalgia on. They're not going to be able to run their old things or go on eBay and grab themselves a game or anything because all the servers are down.
Yeah. Boo.
All the servers are down. That's going to be my my autobiography title.
Right.
Or my sex tape.
All right. I think that means it's time to move on.
Yeah.
I get that a lot.
Michael.
Okay.
You have some mice. Oh, yes, I should say. Tell us about the episode number.
Well, the episode number 159 in Pax Romana, that is CLIX, clicks. So I have clicked us a mouse. Bad,
very
horrible.
Hooray.
It's horrible, but yeah. But the other interesting thing is, this is from back in the day when a mouse was actually something. So...
when a mouse was a mouse.
A mouse was a mouse.
Of course.
This is the getting punched drunk version of the show.
Yeah. So here we have. This is exactly how my mouse arrived for my Apple IIc when I purchased it. So you have it in this wonderful box, great color, carefully packed inside in a foam insert so it doesn't get damaged. Not that you could have really damaged this tank of a mouse anyway, but here if you want to relive the whole experience from back in the day of getting a mouse for your computer for a mere $49.99 Australian, considerably less in other currencies, is a Apple IIc box mouse with the original manual. Yes, a manual to explain how to use a mouse. So.
It's two pages. The first says plug in. The second page says use mouse.
Yep.
Right.
And being an Apple mouse, it saves you a lot of complexity. There is only one button because we all know the sacred Steve only believed in one button. So he didn't get everything right.
Well, back then we needed a manual on the mouse so that we knew that moving it across the screen did not require picking up the mouse.
That's actually true, though, and even which direction to hold it. You see pictures of people holding a mouse with the cable coming out toward them, and there was a period where it was new. This mouse would have come out with. People should have known by then.
It was all new.
All new.
Yeah, so this is back in 84, so people should have had an idea.
I'm pretty sure there was a Lisa ad with Kevin Costner or somebody like using a mouse in a really bizarre way.
Yeah, he uses it that way.
I'm sure that was the one, but I do remember a picture of a person... from back in the day where they're using the mouse, and as you said, the cable, the cord is coming out of like the tail, so that they're saying, oh, this is the direction that it should go. So I don't know, maybe back then there were people who were confused and really did need to read the manual on using a mouse. But enough mousing around. Just going to quickly go over two that I've got here. CD-ROMs. Back in the day when that was before you had your Wikipedia or online information, here are two titles, Leonardo the Inventor and Compton's Encyclopedia. So this is how I originally started getting all of my computer-based information. So like a lot of people, I've got Encyclopedia Britannica and other CD-ROM titles The idea being that if you wanted to find out something, you put in your index disc and then went searching for what it was, and maybe you had to swap platters, and eventually you found half a paragraph on something and you were none the wiser. So if you're after to recreate that experience, here are two titles, starting bids $1 each. Now, the item which I've got in my list that I really like is a Tandy Radio Shack radio-controlled van. This just so reeks 80s, both in the style, the colour, the detailing, even down to the steering wheel on the RC unit. Now,
that is amazing.
Yeah. So, yeah, things were a lot simpler back then. So, it says that it's currently not working. So if you're willing to risk the opening bid of $5, again, this one's in Australia, so that'll be even less again in US dollars, maybe this one's for you. If you want something that's a little bit of an off beige with some ochre and red sort of like trim on there, bit of a brown, this could be just what your collection's crying out for. So, did any of you guys sort of get computer-based vehicles and things to go with your collectibles back in the day? Or is it just something that you just trip over these days in nostalgia land?
I actually have a set somewhere. Actually, no, I think I sent them to a listener. I used to have a set of the little Hot Wheels cars that were the reissues for the Atari stuff.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Like a centipede car and those things. So yeah, I got a set of those and sent them to some listener. Somebody listener out there has that set. So briefly I had those, but I never had a vintage RC Tandy or otherwise van. Although I think this looks more 70s than 80s, which isn't a bad thing. I think it's awesomely 70s. Maybe I just think all vans are from the 70s.
It's definitely right on that boundary, but...
that boundary, that cusp of no taste and bad taste.
Yeah.
But it looks so... I'm restraining myself from bidding on this one. It's so hard. I'm going to have to switch the tab over to something else.
Yeah, it looks like there was a version of this called the Thunder Van that was the Sears version.
Mm. Yes, I'm sure there were quite a lot with just different decals applied.
Yeah, cool. Very cool.
All right. Is that it?
I think that's now it is time for my little pile.
Now
for your pile.
Yeah. How many do you have, Paul?
Well, I'm going to select some. I put more in the show notes than I even usually do. But so this time I really am going to skip some. Okay, so the first one I wanted to mention, it's expensive, but it's kind of interesting, is there's a North Star Horizon. I think this is being sold by the same person who's been listing kind of more beat up North Star Horizon for a while. But this one is, it's got a box, it's, you know, tested to work. The wood is not all split up. It looks really quite nice. It's a starting bid of $5,000, so it's not kidding around, although it's free shipping, at least to me. And you could buy it now for $7,000. So it's conceivable that if this was your dream machine and, you know, you had a bunch of extra money around, it might actually almost be worth it. But
really?
It's
okay.
I don't know. I mean, like, it's, well, yeah, I don't know. I can't decide. It's a lot, but this is in better shape than almost any I've ever seen.
Yep.
I think I've seen that.
Really, really want one.
Yeah, I think I've seen this one listed somewhere before. The chip near the floppy drive looks familiar.
Okay, man.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, but there is another one that I think maybe once or twice we've had on this, you know, like the eBay auctions, that is much more beat up on the left side.
You really just want one of these, don't you, Paul?
Well, a wooden computer. Who doesn't want a wooden computer?
Okay, you know what? Well put. I do actually want a wooden computer. That is true. You win this one.
Yeah. The box has certainly taken a beating.
But there's no way I'm dropping $5,000 on a wooden computer, even if it's gorgeous.
Yeah, you know, like,
And $5,000 US, there isn't even that much Canadian money. It doesn't convert. We don't have that much money up here.
I suspect that it is not going to go actually for even that starting bid, but I don't know what I would call a reasonable starting bid. You know, the more I think about this, the more I think, yeah, that is a lot.
And it does, it's got to buy it now, but it doesn't have a make offer thing. Though I don't know if you can do a make offer if you also are offering bids. I think the bid is.
I think you can't. Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see. I think if it had been listed with a 1,000 starting bid, it would go. I'm not sure about this, but. Oh, all right. Okay, so the next one is a Sony Series 35 Model 10. I don't know what to say about this thing. I think it's just kind of interesting. I don't think I've seen such a thing before. It's a little Sony thing that wants to look like a Mac. I think it might actually be mainly a word processor machine. But what a weird thing. So it looks a little bit like if he stood far enough away and didn't really know 9-inch Macs very well, you would think that this was a Mac.
With two floppy disks, though, beside each other. That's the giveaway.
True.
Dual floppy.
Well, and the big Sony and the ugliness.
There's also the Sony and the ugliness, yes.
I love the carry case.
I've never seen one of these before.
No, I almost kind of want it just because of the weirdness of it. But
I love the carry case. Wonder if you could fit something nice in it instead.
Like a Mac?
Yeah, and no one would take it because it looks like it looks like it's been in somebody's basement for 20 years.
Yeah, when they said
should have remained.
Yeah. When I dug this up, I think they would be literal.
Yeah, I have not come across this before. I think I probably wouldn't want it except for the fact that it looks kind of like a Mac. But it is a buy it now of $280, $60 shipping to me at least. So
Paul buys so
trivial.
Much stuff they now list separately shipping to
Paul.
Yeah,
shipping to
you
Paul.
Can, from your pop-up menu to pick your countries, you can pick Paul. You know you have bought too much stuff when that is the case.
Right. Okay, let's see. Next thing is, I think we've talked about this before, but this is a not super expensive instance of the TRS-80 Dancing Demon program. So this is, it comes with a little, the nice colorful little card and the little manual and the cassette. And so if you wanted to find this, they're interesting.
Yeah, for $40, that's a lot less than this comes up for. We've talked about this before.
Mm.
Like there's another one on eBay at the moment I see, and it's $190. So.
Right. And, it is a collectible thing. It's interesting because it seems like it's very famous. Like everybody knows about this. But yet there aren't very many for sale. So I guess maybe everybody stole them.
Welcome to old software.
Yeah.
But like, I'm totally going to steal Nox Arcanist.
Right. anyway, so cool to see. Okay. So the next one I actually want to mention is it's a 16 millimeter film. It is called The Information Revolution. It is a 1982 documentary. It's an actual film reel that you would be buying. It's turned all red, but although it is, I think it is in color. But
the color red.
Yeah, it's just highly, highly, highly red tinted. As far as I know, this is not archived anywhere. I don't know what to make of this. It looks like it might be kind of interesting. It might not be. But you've got some. An actual, like little pictures of an Atari 800 there, little kid using it.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is the kind of thing that should be snatched up and digitized.
Absolutely should be.
Paul.
Yeah. Well, I have no good way to get something off of a 16 millimeter film.
The condition
though.
Is good with no vinegar odor. See, this is the kind of thing like I wouldn't even known to think about that. Like I don't know anything about film, but who knew? 9 minutes long, sound unreal.
Yeah, interesting. 9 minutes. Hmm. And so then you start looking at the starting bid of $65 and you think,
That's $7.22 a minute.
Yeah, right.
Lucky this wasn't a full-length film.
Yeah. I don't know. I really want to be able to see this. I don't know what to think about this, but I will let you, listener, think about this on your own.
Well, I look forward to you projecting it at Kansas Fest. So you can get this and then show it at Kansas Fest and charge us all like $1 to see it. And then you get your money back.
Recoup the costs.
Little film thing. It'll burst into flames. That'll be exciting. I want to film the projection of the film.
Yeah, see, that's the thing that I would actually make me most nervous, I think, is that because I don't really know what I'm doing.
It doesn't smell like vinegar, though, so I say take it. I think all auctions should say that, whether or not something smells like vinegar. From now on, I want to know. Before I bid on anything, I'm going to email the person, does this smell like vinegar? Mm. I'm going to become the guy who asks that.
Now, wouldn't be a good selling item if someone was selling bulk vinegar, though.
Well, I still want to know. Does it have that pure vinegar smell I'm looking for?
If it didn't, there'd be a pretty big problem.
Exactly. Right. If somebody writes back, no, but it does smell a lot like 16mm film.
Yeah, right. So, does not smell like vinegar, does not include map of the Mars, of Mars, or whatever, right?
But everything includes a map of Mars if you're just vague enough with what you intend by map and Mars.
The actually, I noticed one thing on this. So the auction here for this movie has actually quite a lot of little images from it. So I mean, clearly it was projected, and the seller took photos of individual frames.
So if he keeps listing it with new photos every time, we could eventually just assemble a version of this film.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to point out is that the Atari 800 there. There's two frames where you can see it. One has a little kid playing with it, and it's on some kind of actual TV. But behind it, if I'm not mistaken, it looks like it's one of the double height drives.
It is. And oh my God, that kid is Kevin Savitz.
No. Interesting. So
it is. It is one of those double height drive thingies. Wow. Okay.
So. Anyway, perhaps that'll make it almost worth the $65 bid. But
I was just looking at that auction, and down the bottom there's a section called "People Often Ask," and it says, "If I win the auction, can I get the film I won transferred to video or DVD so I can watch it?" The answer is yes. Contact us for more information. So I wonder. I wonder how much it would cost to actually get them to do it, and.
Or would they just sell you a digitized version?
I think it's basically they've got a whole pile of films and things, and they're not going to go and do it off the back. They've basically said there's no returns due to proliferation of film and video transfers. All films are sold as is, no returns, no exchanges. So, which is understandable, but
and also possibly without a case.
Yeah, and also so so you get the film on a reel and that's it. So unless it says it comes in a case or tin or whatever, I wonder if Jason has any contacts to have it digitized.
I bet he would probably know. I mean, it does sort of seem like if they can do it and it's not super, super expensive, it wouldn't hurt to have them do it and then ship you the film, and if you can do it better, then you'll have two.
Yeah.
And also, if it bursts into flames while that's happening, they'll know to go, whoops, we destroyed it, we can refund your money. So it's kind of the safer way to do it, too.
Right. Or if it's, whatever, gets the shipping container sinks in a hurricane, it will have been digitized before it left.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So, all right. Let's see. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And I think maybe, I'll point out one last auction here, which is, it's actually not a very good auction, and it's maybe not even all that good of a price. Lucky you, listener. it's a Quadlink card, which is a card for the IBM PC. So you can put it on this little replica PC that you will have built from a kit, and it allows you to run Apple II software. So it is essentially an Apple II on a card for the IBM PC.
See, it should have slots to be an actual Apple II.
Right. So it's sort of.
And then you put other cards in it. You put a Z80 card in the slot on the Apple II.
Oh, and you can play a ColecoVision game.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Perfect. Oh, I would actually. This,
it
this
slots
seems
all
like
the
a,
way down.
Yeah. I like this more and more now. but these cards are interesting. There's obviously at the time that the IBM PC was out, it was expensive to get any computers. You don't want to get two computers. And if all your kids' school stuff is all on the Apple II, and your business spreadsheets are all on the IBM PC, what do you do? Well, you can buy this card, which is essentially an Apple II on a card, and it sort of intercepts. I think it intercepts the disk drive. And I don't think it I think you have to plug in a monitor separately, though. I have one of these. I have three of these, but I've tried one of them out, and I tried it out on a what was it, IBM Portable? I think it's 5155 is the number, which I was hoping that I could put it in there and then I could route the video to the screen. But actually, it really is it's really like running a separate computer. Like you plug the monitor into the card, you have your PC running, and also your Apple II running.
Okay, I have a question then. Okay, so you have three of these. You tried one and sound kind of disappointed by how it... Did you acquire three before you tried one, or did you try one, were disappointed, and still went on to get two more?
I like the idea still, and I want to play around with them more. But I think it's a kind of a cool thing that they
are you trying to make like a Beowulf cluster of these things or something?
Right, exactly.
Disney always wants those, but you don't actually have to do it.
Very slow searching for extraterrestrial life. But now the thing that disappointed me was the fact that I couldn't route the I couldn't use the internal monitor for the Apple II. And it's possible that I just didn't understand something about that. But what I think is kind of cool about this is that this is the actual box. I think I only have one of the actual boxes and stuff. The auction, however, is terrible. So it shows you kind of like most of a picture of the box and asserts that it the card is there. Says still in original packaging, never used. It would be nice to see pictures of it. It is being sold by someone with zero feedback. Starting bid of $120. So it's
being sold by the person with the office next to you, and they don't think you're going to miss it.
Yeah. Aha.
But, buy again.
Yeah, right.
You may actually have bought this same one three times.
Oh, look, I have an exactly sized space for this. I wonder why that is. But anyway, yeah, so I think... The object is pretty cool, though. I mean, despite my lack of enthusiasm for how you can't use the internal monitor on the 5155, I think it's kind of a neat thing. I was hoping that I could actually like make this a portable Apple II to bring to Kansas Fest, but yeah, it turned out I would still need an external monitor, and 5155 is heavy. I think I will leave it at that. So now I guess we can turn to the closing discussions. I guess, well, alphabetically, Carrington, you are first. Do you have anything that you wanted
That's
to close
baby.
Us off with?
Call me AAA Carrington. Yeah. No, not a lot of retro stuff in my life other than my girlfriend. Yeah, I got a girlfriend. She lives in Canada. You wouldn't know her. That never gets old.
Nope.
She's in Wales at the moment, riding a horse across the country. There's some, like, you can take horse girls. I don't know. She's taking some sort of tour where you ride across Wales on a horse. So I'm staying at her place to look after her 1,000 animals. And...
ironically, also a horse.
She does own a horse, but her internet is so slow that I feel like I'm back on modems. So I'm having a retro feel this week, but it's not like a fun one. So that's all I got going on retro-wise is slow internet. It's frustrating. I mostly just want to say I have a girlfriend. I look for her. I really just I noticed that was transparent enough, but I just look for a reason to say that.
Right. All right. Well, Mark, so... sorry that we didn't like. I feel like you were sort of patiently listening to a lot of this, but what sort of closing thoughts do you have?
No, that's fine. It was interesting the discussion. I would have listened to it online anyway, so I'm certainly happy to chime in where I could. So no, just in closing, thanks everyone who's been following Nox Arcast and especially those that have supported the Kickstarter and. Anybody listening who hasn't, please help us out here. And, hopefully, because you want to play the game, but even if you don't, the more support we get, the more backers we get, the more likely, it is that, RPG developers and game developers in general, not just for the Apple II, but for all retro platforms will pursue projects like this. So, please, if not, do it, if not for us, do it for the community.
But also just do it for that, because I want that darn game. I want a cool boxed version, and I cannot wait. And the tiers are awesome, and the game is going to be incredible. The gameplay stuff is blowing me away. I'm very, very excited about Nox Arcast. So everyone should be supporting it. And support it now. Don't wait till the last stinking day. I hate people that do that. You're going to get the game right now when you hear this. You go support the Kickstarter.
Kickstarter.noxarcast.com.
And none of the levels require soldering.
Nope.
Oh, good.
And you can hide in the grass.
Yes. No soldering required, and you can hide in the grass. Can you beat that? And go swimming. You want to go swimming out?
You go swimming at your own risk.
Yes. Yes, you got it, Carrington. Swim at your own risk. I can't imagine what might be lurking out in the water there, but it is definitely at your own risk.
I'm so excited for this game. It's just like a new Ultima, but better. I'm so excited.
You go swimming and then, like, you know, have some chance of getting run over by a moving way too fast Ultima ship, like, mowing you down.
Yes, there's the, and you can catch the insignia of LB on the sails as it runs over.
Oh, I'd love to see that. What level do I have to subscribe to get the runaway boat?
Yeah. We'll have to create a level just for that. It's the stretch goal. We'll have to create a stretch goal that includes cutscenes. That's how people can get that.
Excellent.
Awesome.
All right, Michael, you have some challenging news for us.
I have challenging news. Retro Challenge is back. So for all of you who have recovered from your last Retro Challenge 6 months ago, it's time to either dust off that project you didn't finish and try this time, or to come up with something new. So pop over to retrochallenge.org and let us know what your challenge is for the wonderful month of October, and then keep us appraised in blogs, tweets, and whatever, and I'm sure there'll be lots of wonderful prizes out there, so join us for some retro challenging fun.
Yes, I will try. I will think about trying.
Excellent.
I'm planning next week to think about trying.
Well, don't leave it too late, because you have to do all your thinking this month and your doing next month. So,
right.
So do your thinking next month. Just think about thinking this month.
Perfect. Yes. I'm sure it's going to wind up being a Halloween entry.
Yeah. And Paul, you've got some sad news.
Yes. Yes. Well, so, I have no time, you know, like basically like I have time to collect the packages that come in and, you know, sort of like add them to the various piles. But one thing that that I've just recently sort of re-noticed was that I've been basically since I've started scanning things and whatever, I've been using Dropbox. I have a very, you know, sort of paid regular, you know, like large space Dropbox. And
yep, same here.
And you know, so I have a folder that I put all my scans and stuff in, and I put it in my public area because I thought, well, that's actually, you know, it's a pretty easy way to share stuff. And it was actually I don't know if it's true in Windows, but in the Mac it was pretty well integrated with Finder, so you could just sort of like right click and get a public link, and then I could like tweet it out. And so if, you know, people would mention something on the Apple II Facebook group, and I would say, oh, I have the manual for that, and I'd tweet a link, or like post a link, or on Twitter I would, you know, scan some magazine and tweet that out. And as of, I think, the beginning of this month, all of those links are broken, and they will never come back. Dropbox has turned off the public sharing of all that kind of link, and it's a real... I'm really not pleased about it, because everything I have linked to in the past is broken. Everything on my blog is mostly hosted that way because it was easy. And so, you know, I it's perfectly possible to just move everything onto the hosting site and host it directly, and I'll move everything to archive.org anyway. But at the moment, I'm just faced with 404s everywhere, and not too happy about that. So, right.
Sucks.
And this is the problem with Earl. This is the problem with Earl.
Yeah, Earl. This is your fault for not being able to share.
This is the problem with URL shorteners. Earl shorteners.
That Earl.
But
I was looking through the show notes. Was there Earl on the show?
No, because he knows what he did. He remembered all of these links. URL shorteners suck.
Yes. And we have, since Ken is not here, we cannot have any defense of this, but I don't think he would have convinced me anyway. I mean, like, if Libya falls, there's going to be, like, nobody is going to have any links that work anymore.
Yeah. It stinks. But, I worry about it. But that also particularly stinks, like, immediately for you, though. That's ugh.
I think a lot of people actually use this. I mean, like, and mm-hmm. I was kind of in denial. I mean, like, I think it went away in the like unpaid Dropbox, like almost a year ago. But I kind of figured, I don't know what I was thinking, but I did not address it. And then the deadline came and went, and now everything is 404. So, oh well. And I posted about it on the blog, and it showed up on Retro Roundup.
But nobody can read on the blog because all your links are 404.
Right.
None of us can get to it.
Oh well. So that's
we had to end on a happy note.
Hooray! That's my news. But I'll get to it. I'll fix it. But yeah, it's been just like work life has been very busy. So not soon, someday. All right. I guess that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. I never go there. I should go there. I keep saying that every single time.
It's too long a URL. Is there a shortened version?
Yeah. But I'm sure it's interesting. I've enjoyed my visits to the VC Fed forums, but I just don't go there as often as I should, given how often we say those.
Good thing we can just click on the link rather than shortening it.
Yes. you can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. Send feedback to us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, which has all sorts of retro-themed podcasts. If you want to give us 5 stars, you can write a review for us on iTunes. If you want to give us fewer stars, you can go do something else. Go outside. It's nice.
But step carefully.
But step carefully. Watch out for ants. Yes, and until next time...
Retro-compute! It was over 2 hours, dude.
Was it? It was.
Yeah.
You shouldn't hang me on a hook. My father hung me on a hook once. Once.